Our first speaker today is Dr. Pedro Alvarez, the George R. Brown Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Rice University, where he also serves as founding director of the NSF Engineering Research Center on Nanotechnology-Enabled Water Treatment. His research interests include environmental implications and applications of nanotechnology, bioremediation, fate and transport of toxic chemicals, water footprint of biofuels, water treatment and reuse, and antibiotic resistance control. Pedro received his Bachelor's of Engineering degree in Civil Engineering from McGill University and his Master's and PhD degrees in Environmental Engineering from the University of Michigan. He is a 2012 Clark Prize laureate and won the 2014 AAEES Grand Prize for Excellence in Environmental Engineering and Science. He was elected to the National Academy of Engineering for pedagogical and practical contributions to bioremediation and environmental nanotechnology. Pedro, I will now turn it over to you.
Interesting webinar, and let me begin by recognizing the importance of clean water for global health and economic development, which cannot be overstated. And because of this, and when we consider that groundwater represents about 98% of the available fresh water in the planet, that underscores the importance to protect and remediate contaminated aquifers. So what I want to do today is present a vision of how nanotechnology can help us improve the selectivity and the efficiency of remediation efforts to remove priority pollutants. Some of these work will be extrapolations of the work that we do at NEWT. But much of my research has always been at the convergence of nanotechnology with microbiology, so this will give me an opportunity to discuss opportunities to enhance bioremediation. So let me begin very quickly to remind you that nanotechnology is about understanding and controlling matter, working on a scale of 1 to 100 nanometers to manipulate atoms and molecules to create new structures that exhibit unique size-dependent properties that enable novel applications. And at this scale, the properties of matter change. Take gold, for example. Gold is a very inert material. That's why we use it in jewelry. It doesn't corrode. But at this scale, it can become a hypercatalyst. And carbon, which is a good insulator, can become a superconductor at this scale. So that means that engineered nanomaterials can offer new and exciting opportunities for hazardous waste treatment. Many of these opportunities are for above ground pump and treat schemes, but there are also some that can be applied for in situ applications as well. For example, we can take advantage of the large surface area of nanomaterials to develop superior sorbents to remove radionuclides, or take advantage of the hypercatalytic properties of some materials and their resistance to fouling to treat chlorinated solvent plumes, as well as make water filtration membranes or groundwater filtration membranes that are fouling resistant and have self-cleaning properties, or superior, highly selective adsorbents that are also reactive, so that they not only separate pollutants with great precision, but also destroy them, and also the high conductivity of some materials to make selective electrosorption or highly efficient electrocatalytic treatment systems. Now, by way of disclaimer, no technology is universally applicable, and nanotechnology will not make sense in many cases, but it will make sense when you're dealing with an insufficiency or inability to meet current or upcoming regulations, when it can enhance cost effectiveness, that is, make the cleanup go faster using less energy and less material. And sometimes you need modular processes with a smaller footprint that needs to be transported to remote locations, whether it is an oil and gas platform in the sea or other space constraints, and you need just a smaller systems, and here nanotechnology can help. So a lot of the opportunities for site remediation are in targeting highly recalcitrant pollutants, for example, perfluorinated compounds where biodegradation alone might be ineffective and you need to get it kick-started, or to enhance the selectivity towards the target pollutants so that you don't waste your treatment capacity on things that don't matter. or to enhance multifunctionality, and I'll expand on this, to address contamination by different classes of pollutants that require different conditions. Sometimes it is useful to decrease the energy requirements for thermal treatment or to improve the characterization of source zones are the remediation by either advanced oxidation processes or advanced reduction processes. So I'm going to give you some examples, and I'm going to begin by the first and oldest application of a nanomaterial, which is that of zero-valent iron, the nanoscale zero-valent iron. As you know, zero-valent iron is a very powerful reductant. It has a reduction potential of minus 409 millivolts, and it can reductively dechlorinate trichloroethylene or reduce uranium or chromium or nitrate. So it can treat a wide variety of oxidized pollutants, and the general idea is that we inject the zero-valent iron to create an in-situ reactive zone or a permeable reactive barrier. And when the iron corrodes, it releases electrons that literally bombard these pollutants and reduces them. And it has been used at least in 70 full-scale or pilot tests in the United States, so we know a lot about it. And the connection to bioremediation is that iron can reduce water to form hydrogen. And this cathodic hydrogen is a powerful biostimulant. It can stimulate anaerobic bioremediation. Specifically, there are some bacteria that can serve as electron shuttles to transfer electrons from this hydrogen to target pollutants, sometimes offering alternative pathways that lead to better end products. In the example here, I'm showing the degradation of RDX, which, as you know, is a trinitrotriazine explosive. RDX can be reduced directly by iron. You can see over here that it forms some nitroso byproducts that are a problem, in, including, not shown here, Medina, or what is known as methylene dinitramine. And bacteria can serve as polishing agents to reduce further to more benign products like methane or CO2. And also bacteria can directly, bioremediate and mineralize RDX in iron systems. So in this example, we're looking at the mineralization of RDX by tracing 14 CO2 for radiolabeled CO2. That is emanating in these microcosms. And I want to point out that the abiotic system where iron is alone does remove, does degrade RDX, but it is not mineralized. But when bacteria that do mineralize it is combined with iron, you get a much higher degree of complete destruction to CO2 and methane. And what this is telling us is that, bacteria are responsible for mineralization here, and iron provides a favorable reducing environment and the needed electrons for this anaerobic bioremediation process. Now, iron a lot of times is coated so that it doesn't cluster, so that we can deliver it more efficiently and distribute it through contaminated zones. And the coating is typically negatively charged, for example, polyaspartate. And that is good because it causes some electrostatic repulsion versus bacteria. And because, frankly, the alternative is that if iron becomes in direct contact with bacteria, as shown here on the left, then that is toxic to bacteria. It creates some Fenton-like reactions and oxidative stress, and it kills bacteria. This is why we're showing here that the viability of bacteria decreases as the iron dose increases. But when they are coated, when the iron is coated, then the bacteria are protected and do not die. You can see some bacteria here reproducing happily by binary fission. And this is very important for some bacteria that are finicky and very sensitive, such as halorespirers. Take, for example, the Halococcoides ethanogens that is sensitive even to surfactants and, of course, to iron. When you have this bacteria present and the iron is uncoated, using transcriptomic analysis, that is reverse transcriptase polymerase chain reaction, we see that the dechlorination genes, TCEA and VCER, are significantly repressed. But however, when the iron is coated, then of course we see much better performance of these dehalogenation enzymes, and of course a greater extent of dechlorination. The details are in the ZNCT article that we wrote in collaboration with Greg Lowry. But I also want to highlight the importance of selectivity. You see, iron preferentially reacts with water, and therefore a lot of those the treatment capacity is not directed towards the target, which is in this example, trichloroethylene. However, an easy trick to overcome this issue is sulfidation. When we sulfidate the iron with a little sulfur, then the electrons are more directly and more preferentially reach the target of dechlorinating TCE, which is beneficial. And there are several groups, such as Paul Tratnik's lab, Suhashish Ghoshal, and Graham Lowry, and others, that are working on such manipulation of the iron nanoparticles to make them more efficient. Switching to another example, I want to talk about another process, photocatalysis, that can be coupled to bioremediation, especially of oil spills. In this example, I want to remind you that photocatalytic treatment is about illuminating catalysts with the appropriate lights of the right wavelength. To basically the electrons are jumped to the conduction band, and more importantly, we leave an electron hole behind that can oxidize water and generate reactive oxygen species like hydroxyl radicals that can attack a wide target of pollutants. Now, by the way, the TiO2 that we use here is food grade. That means it's very cheap. It's about $1 per pound, and it's approved by the FDA even for as a food colorant to make those white donuts look whiter than normal. But the point here is one of the first things I learned in graduate school was that the rate limiting step for biodegradation of heavy hydrocarbons is the first step, hydroxylation. That makes the molecule easier to metabolize. It makes it more soluble and more bioavailable. However, when you have an oil spill that has been weathered, as was the case of the Macondo blow up, in the Gulf of Mexico, you may recall, shown over here. A lot of this weather oil that reaches the shores is very difficult to biodegrade. It's not bioavailable. So our proposed solution is to sprinkle over it some titanium dioxide food grade and let sunlight, which has 5% UV, stimulate it and generate reactive oxygen species that attack and hydroxylate or fragment the heavier hydrocarbons, making them more bioavailable and more amenable for bioremediation. So we tried this out. We went to Barataria Bay in Louisiana, took some samples and brought them to the lab and sprinkled some food-grade TiO2. And according to our hypothesis, we saw that after one day exposure to sunlight, we observed a significant increase in dissolved organic carbon. Again, this was being hydroxylated, we believe, and becoming more bioavailable. And when we then put the samples in a respirometer to see oxygen consumption, we see a significant increase in oxygen consumption, therefore in heterotrophic activity. And higher removal of the organic carbon, suggesting that this could be a promising alternative, but it may even be used to enhance land farming operations in some cases, provided that light penetration is not a major limiting factor, which could be in some cases. Now, looking forward on a more futuristic perspective, an important challenge in bioremediation is that we often have mixtures of different pollutants that require different requirements or reagents or treatment times. For example, we know that organic pollutants are commonly removed by redox reaction, oxidation or reaction or reduction, whereas some heavy metals and radionuclides require adsorption or precipitation. And if we can combine many of these functions in a synergistic manner, because we can design materials that combine these functions, then we could concurrently target contaminant mixtures and sometimes maybe even enable multiple remediation pathways, as illustrated in this cartoon. For example, I could have a nanomaterial trap an organic pollutant, concentrate it on the surface, and then zap it using an advanced oxidation or catalytic process. And we would call this strategy trap and zap. Now, in such strategies, of course, one advantage of nanomaterials is that they can enhance the precision by which you remove pollutants. They can be very selective towards very specific contaminants to sequester them or, after you sequester them, zap them, as I illustrated soon. And selectivity is very desirable for several reasons. First, you have to recognize that the selectivity or absorption capacity of any material is finite. And a non-selective reagent or material is exhausted quickly. So you end up wasting a lot of that treatment capacity. For example, iron, I gave you that example, tends to react with water, and you waste a lot of that reduction capacity on iron rather than the chlorinated solvent that you want to target. But also, when you have higher selectivity, you limit off-target reactivity, which lowers the amount of remediation agents that you need to use. And current remediation technologies, frankly, lack selectivity, which wastes a lot of treatment capacity. Another interesting potential application here is to use DNA combined with nanomaterials as traces that are highly selective and that also enhance the sensitivity. This is desirable for several reasons. First of all, the idea is that the DNA, we know how to detect it at very, very low levels. And when you combine it with a nanomaterial, we can protect it, protect the DNA from being degraded by enzymes, by minerals, by microorganisms that might be present in the site. And this high specificity and low selectivity for DNA analysis allows you to do precise tracking of nanotraces with minimal background noise. Also, you have to recognize that there are infinite different sequences of DNA that you can use. That means that you can have simultaneous application of multiple and distinguishable tracers, where you can tune their migration behavior or hydrophobicity. For example, we can have some tracers that preferentially go into NAPLs. So if they disappear, this tracer, you know that you have a NAPL there, as an example. This can be used to map spatial heterogeneities or hydraulic or chemical properties of the contaminated zones. Another thing that the nanotechnology or nanomaterials can help is thermal treatment. This is an interesting possibility. We have some ferromagnetic nanoparticles that have unique electromagnetic hysteresis properties. For example, you take nanomagnetite or even zero-valent iron. You could deliver it into a contaminated zone, and then you can heat it by applying, for example, a radio frequency. And basically, this is something called Brown and Neal relaxations. These are hysteristic behavior that can increase the temperature. You can easily increase the temperature to, say, 90 degrees Celsius. And this can enhance thermal dissolution of the NAPL, if you want to do that, or desorption of volatile organic compounds from contaminated soil or volatilization from the vital zone. So the idea is to heat it up, and of course, in some cases, warmer temperatures could be beneficial to faster bioremediation. For example, I don't know, in Alaska or in the Arctic. And that was what I was trying to show you here, that you can use these low-frequency electromagnetic fields to heat up nanoparticles to these Brown and Neal relaxations. Another interesting possibility is the synthesis of nanomaterials to in situ so that they can reach low permeability zones. As you know, these low permeability zones are notoriously difficult to treat because it is difficult to deliver reagents into them. And even nanomaterials would have a hard time reaching them and getting inside. But we can use dissolved metals like iron and manganese that can spontaneously become nanoparticles and metal oxides through, for example, hydrolysis. And you can make metal sulfides in situ as well. And these particles could then be used to target a variety of chemicals. For example, iron nanocrystals like pyrite or magnetite can absorb or reduce organic and inorganic contaminants as well. Farther down the pipeline is the possibility to design active and adaptive nanomaterials that respond to environmental stimuli. It could be a change in pH or a change in redox potential, or more practically, a change in temperature that you can induce by applying microwave or radio frequency radiation. And then you will have targeted reactivity on demand. I'm talking about, for example, a porous material that has these small cages that trap inside either an oxidant or a reductant, and they are then coated with a polymer that can undergo a conformational change when it is heated. And you can heat it by, for example, again, applying microwave or radio frequency from above the ground that opens up the polymer, opens up the cage, and then it releases on demand your oxidant or your reagent. And again, just a low-frequency radio wave will do the job to manipulate and relax the polymer and release the reactive ingredients. And finally, some nanomaterials can oxidize or reduce highly recalcitrant pollutants or those that are very poorly bioavailable, and transform them into more soluble and more biodegradable products so that we can enhance microbial participation in the remediation process. Some nanomaterials could also be used to deliver nutrients or even oxygen. For example, you can do nanoparticulate calcium peroxide can be used to overcome oxygen limitations, or to generate reactive oxygen species through Fenton-like reactions to enhance in situ chemical oxidation. Some nanomaterials can also serve as electron acceptors or electron shuttles to promote biodegradation of oxidized or of some pollutants. And on a more futuristic side, you could deliver signal molecules that exert positive chemotaxy to attract specific degraders to source zones. You could even include signal molecules associated with quorum sensing so that you could attract specific degraders and manipulate the microbial community structure in the future. So this is, of course, more down the line of ideas or possibilities that are yet to be demonstrated. But anyways, to wrap it up, make sure I have enough time left for questions, I will say that nanotechnology offers some interesting opportunities for environmental remediation, either for facilitating, accelerating, or polishing other degradation processes, or to trigger or kickstart bioremediation. I think that although many of these possibilities are for above-ground treatment by means of enhancing treatment selectivity and multifunctionality, it could also be used, again, as biostimulants or to enhancing bioavailability of some pollutants. Now, Steve Jobs used to say that people don't know what they want until you show it to them. So in this regard, it is very important that we conduct some pilot studies to delineate the practical applicability and limitation of all of these possibilities. But overall, I would say that nanotechnology is not going to be a panacea that will be universally applicable, but it is certainly rapidly earning an important place in the menu of alternatives and the toolbox that we use to select solutions to our increasing groundwater pollution challenges. So with that, I'm going to stop and maybe open the floor for potential questions. That took 24 minutes.
Thank you, Pedro. We did receive a number of questions about applicability of nanotechnologies, so I'll throw a couple of those your way right now. So first off, has nanotechnology been used in remediation of chlorides in groundwater?
Did you say chloride? And rather than chlorine, the answer is we are doing that at the pilot scale at the flow through. What we do is selective electrosorption. But a lot of times we prefer to remove other things than chloride. We prefer to remove, for example, for the oil and gas industry, multivalent cations that cause scaling or that are toxic, like hexavalent chromium. We use selective electrosorption for that. And for anions, we prefer to remove sulfate that causes souring later and corrosion. So, but it's certainly through manipulations or enhancement of what is known as capacity deionization, we can improve that process. We can improve the adsorption capacity by having electrodes with higher surface area and higher charge density. And so it's certainly possible.
Okay, great. Thank you. Next up, can iron reduce chlorinated solvents in aerobic conditions?
Under anaerobic, did you say aerobic or anaerobic?
I said aerobic.
It is difficult, but iron can also stimulate Fenton-like reactions in under aerobic conditions and produce hydroxyl radicals that will attack. It will not be a reduction. It will be more of an oxidation or a nucleophilic substitution if superoxide is involved.
Okay. Now, can nanomaterials be used to enhance remediation of saline groundwater?
Again, this is an issue of, so it will perform. Saline salt can poison many catalysts. Nanocatalysts are more, sturdy, more resilient to high salinity than regular catalysts. But if you want to basically remove salt, there are probably other options. One of them that we use is nanophotonic enhanced solar distillation. And what we do is we use the sunlight, which is a free source of energy, to generate vapor and desalinate it that way. Let's remember, we know how to desalinate already. We have reverse osmosis. The problem is that it is too expensive. And 55% of the cost of desalination by reverse osmosis is energy. We use a free source, the sun, with nanophotonics to generate vapor and desalinate by distillation. So it is possible.
Okay, thank you. One more question here. Let's see. So which total petroleum hydrocarbon compounds can be treated using nanomaterials in land farming? So specifically...
Interesting. So in these examples that we did, to be honest with you, we were not discerning the compounds. We were just looking at TPH. As you know, in land farming, a lot of the, by the time you get there, a lot of the volatile compounds have already left. The only one that we followed closely were some of the PAHs, the polynuclear aromatic hydrocarbons. But I have to admit, success was limited to light penetration. Light was only capable of penetrating about 1 centimeter. And so only the surface of the soil got treated.
Okay, interesting. Now, do you have any concerns about changes in pH due to nanoremediation?
You always have to watch that out for, but it depends on the case. Sometimes you add nanomaterials with the purpose of changing the pH locally so that you can precipitate better heavy metals or radionuclei. But yes, I mean, it depends on the process that you're trying to simulate. Some of them are pH sensitive, and there are ways around that. We know how to buffer, for example, reactions.
Okay, and that would probably help mitigate any negative side effects you might have on, say, soil ecosystems.
Precisely, yes. And that's one of the important advantages of higher selectivity is that you minimize offside unintended consequences that degrade soil quality because you're only preferentially reacting or removing the target.
Great, okay. Now, can you talk about any nanotechnology that has been used for cleaning up contaminated sediments, like for, say, PCBs?
No, the only that I would say is that zero-valent iron, of course, can reduce especially the more highly chlorinated, PCBs, so through reductive abiotic dechlorination. Most of the applications that we are developing in our center are for either drinking water treatment for people that are off the grid and emergency response and humanitarian water, as well as for challenges of the oil and gas industry, for example, fracking waters or produced waters from oil and gas fields. That's what we are concentrating on right now, but I have always had an interest of extrapolating some of these technologies, and I would be happy to collaborate with anybody that is interested that has foot on the ground and hands on the problem to see if this would work.
Okay, so they know where to find you. We've got your email.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Let me see. I think I've got some more here. Actually, since we've got just a minute, let me see if there's anyone on the phone that has a question. If you have a question on the phone, you can press #6 to unmute yourself. I'll give that just a moment. Okay. Now, I don't hear any on the phone, but I've got a couple more questions here. Is it ever the case where the nanomaterial itself becomes something that needs to be remediated, or how do we avoid that?
Yeah, so in the early days of nanotechnology, there were a lot of concerns about the potential toxicity or unintended consequences of nanotechnology, and it was a balance here between the precautionary principle or being innocent until proven guilty. Now, a lot of those concerns have been dissipated as we learn more, as we conduct toxicological studies under more realistic conditions. We have learned over 20 years of research by multiple groups that the benefits tend to outweigh the potential concerns. However, it is important to do two things. Number one, try to use materials that are earth abundant, avoid endangered elements, and that are generally regarded as safe. When possible, use them food grade, like the titanium dioxide I mentioned here or the nanomagnetite that I mentioned. That is available as a food colorant to make chocolate look darker. So if we can use food grade nanomaterials, the better. And the second, you have to remember that the concentrations that we use are very small. It doesn't take much to make a difference. So in that sense, you always need to be careful but not afraid of these sort of new technologies.
Yeah, and on that note, someone also asked about whether nanomaterials could migrate through groundwater and then if they could also be potentially discharged to surface water. And can you talk about how that's something else that you would take into consideration in your design?
Yeah, well, some of them, by the time they would reach the surface water, they would be essentially, for example, the iron is rust, essentially. And so that's not a big concern, really. I mean, we probably get more rust from in our pipelines in the tap water than what would be reaching there. It's hard for them to travel very far, to be honest with you, because they get filtered, by the groundwater medium, but it's possible that there could be some colloidal transport and so on. But again, the issue here is that to use nanomaterials that are generally regarded as safe, that are approved by the USDA, you need to kick the tires and do careful toxicological studies as we do. But we have a significant effort in our Center for Safety and Sustainability that consider all of these questions, and we're certainly, the greatest concern, I will tell you, with the when you apply nanomaterials, is not the nanomaterial itself. It's the pollutants that are concentrated or absorbed onto it. And that's why, if you're making, you're using a nanoadsorbent that is concentrating the uranium, you certainly need to be very careful as to how you separate it and avoid exposure.
That's why you want to trap and zap, not just trap, right?
That's exactly right, yes.
Okay, great. One person asked, have you tried any nanotechnology cleanup with in using sewage sludge or biosolids?
No, because to be honest with you, the competition, which is a typical traditional biological treatment, would be hard to beat. For biosolids, I mean, I would consider maybe some pyrolysis in some cases to make biochar, but in many cases, just your standard digestion and stabilization just does the job, as well as for sewage treatment. It's hard to beat bacteria, you know, to do wastewater treatment. Unless there is something in the effluent that you need to polish, for example, let's say that the wastewater treatment plant, some nasty pharmaceuticals are escaping, then yes, I would do an advanced oxidation process for polishing that could be nano-enabled. That would make sense there.
Okay, great. On that note, I had a participant who asked, what are the current costs and the estimated future costs of nanotechnologies compared to other treatment technologies?
Yeah, so that's a too generic of a question. I can tell you that it is not, in some cases, it can be cheaper. We only consider or invest things after we do an early techno-economic analysis and market intelligence to make sure that we're getting into niches where we can at least save 20% of the cost. What I will tell you is this. There are three things that you can do to reduce cost. Number one is avoid the diminishing returns of ultra-high purity, because making nanomaterials is very cheap. What is expensive is to separate them and purify them. But you only need to purify them for research purposes. For high reactivity and functionality, they don't need to be 100% pure. 99% will do it, and that costs 100 times less. The second thing is to enable reuse as much as possible. And the third one is take advantage of the economies of scale. As we have these early gains and the demand for it and the production advances, then it becomes much cheaper to use them. But as you know, as I said, zero valent iron has already been used in like probably about 100 sites worldwide at least. So it is certainly within the scope of... And the proof of that is that we got about 25 large companies as industrial members of our center that are very interested, and they wouldn't be in the game, putting skin in the game, if they didn't believe that this was going to be economically feasible.
True. Okay, well, thank you so much, Pedro. We are going to move along to our next speaker. Thank you for answering these questions, and thank you folks who've been sending questions in through that Q&A pod. Appreciate the lively discussion. So next up, we will hear from Dora Taggart, the president of Microbial Insights. Since joining Microbial Insights in 2001, the company has greatly expanded their array of molecular biological tools that have been developed and validated. This includes the first commercial qPCR analysis through the development of the QuantArray and commercialization of stable isotope probing to the Microbial Insights database. Dora personally analyzed the first commercial Dehalococcoides qPCR samples and continues to propel Microbial Insights forward by collaborating with leading researchers in academia and federal agencies. As president, Dora has become a global ambassador for molecular biological tools, regularly presenting as an invited speaker at environmental and corrosion conferences, leading hundreds of technical workshops worldwide, and co-authoring guidance documents with groups like the Interstate Technology Regulatory Council's Environmental Molecular Diagnostics Teams and EnviroWiki to support appropriate use and interpretation of molecular biological tools. Dora received her degree in biomedical engineering from Vanderbilt University. Dora, I will now turn it over to you.
All right, thank you so much, and thank you for that introduction. Today, I'm really excited to be talking to you, and I'm going to start by going through some of the work that we're doing at Microbial Insights and hopefully show you kind of a well-rounded view that pulls all of these three sessions together into how these different research projects can be used and result in the protection of human health. I'm going to show you kind of what we're doing right now in the environmental world, and then the progression of where I think that's going to go in the future, and then hopefully relate all that to the human health aspect. So I want to kind of frame the discussion around the human gut microbiome and how the environmental microbes that are in the subsurface of a contaminated site can prevent damage to our gut microbiome, and how these two very different microbiomes, environmental and gut, actually have a lot in common. So by highlighting these connections and similarities, I'm hoping that you're going to take away a couple things from my talk today. First, I hope you see how important bioremediation is and all the work that the speakers are doing on this series, and I'm so grateful for NIH for pulling all this together and how important this is to human health. And then two, I hope you take home how possible it is to transition tools from gut microbiome research to bioremediation research and vice versa. So when we're talking about the human gut microbiome, we're talking about a really complex group of organisms, tens of trillions of microbial cells, equal to, if not more than, the number of cells in the entire human body. So we're talking about extreme diversity. Research has shown that there's about 3.3 million non-redundant genes in our gut. So it's no surprise to us that this collection of microbes that we can each carry have some direct effects on the chemistry that happens within our bodies, and by relation, direct effects on our health as well. Multiple studies have shown how the microbiome's utility as a predictor of health and disease. The gut microbiota composition is a better indicator of body mass, blood glucose levels, cholesterol levels, and cardiac health than even genetic factors. The composition of the microbiota of amniotic fluid has been shown to be a predictor of preterm birth. The gut microbiota composition is predictive of hospitalization risk and disease severity in patients with cirrhosis. And if we take all of the research that we've been looking at together, the studies suggest that our microbiota is not only our first line of defense against disease, but it can also be used as an indicator of health status and disease susceptibility. So the founder of Microbial Insights, Dr. David White, many of you are probably familiar with his work, really understood all of these connections to our health and especially understood the threat that environmental contaminants pose to our systems, our first line of defense. Dr. White was both a medical doctor and a PhD, so he was always looking for ways to transition tools from the medical field to the environmental remediation field. Dr. White was thinking in the 1970s how we could use looking at the lipid membranes of microbial organisms and how to understand the subsurface and what's happening in that black box of remediation in our subsurface all the way back then. And he was thinking, how do we take the tools that are commonly used in the medical field and transition that to the environmental remediation field so that we can exchange information and look at the correlations and the relationships between these two groups. So Dr. White was really an inspiration in both these fields. And the legacy that he left is why we really care. That's what we're trying to continue to pursue so we can combat environmental threats and then therefore threats to our health. Not only that, but my lab is based in Appalachia, and we're surrounded by some of the most beautiful natural landscape in the world. And as Pedro mentioned, groundwater is such an important part of our world. So this photo that you're seeing here was taken by a Microbial Insights employee actually about 45 minutes from our facility in Knoxville. So every day I'm lucky enough when I'm driving into work to be constantly reminded of what we're striving for and keeping our world beautiful. So let's talk about a little bit about the molecular analysis we're doing at Microbial Insights. I'm going to discuss a few of the tools and how they're currently being used by managers at sites around the world to produce actionable data and how that data helps site managers to make decisions on where to go next when they're approaching a crossroads at a site. And then hopefully I can relate all of that to the future, where we're going, and show you what we've learned from our past and what that leads into in the future, some questions we're still trying to answer. I'd like to briefly introduce the NIH-funded research study that we're doing with metabolomics, and then close out today by posing a few questions for you to think about. So the first tool that kind of started my career here at Microbial Insights is called quantitative polymerase chain reaction. This is a tool that we can use where we extract the DNA of microorganisms in the soil or groundwater, and then we use this process to help us rapidly detect and quantify genes that we're interested in. So for those of you that aren't familiar, we'll take short segments of DNA called primers or probes, and we'll choose those that are specific to a gene or an organism that we're interested in. As the gene is copied, then a fluorescent signal is released, which is going to be proportional to the concentration of that organism. So we can get really accurate quantifications of organisms using this type of tool. And we can look at two main types of genes that we'll be talking about today. The first are taxonomic genes. If you think about bacterial cells, they have a gene called the 16S, and this gene is the identifying gene. It's the name of that microorganism. Or we can look at functional genes, and we can see what that particular organism does for a living. So we can target, say, an anaerobic benzene carboxylase gene if we're interested in anaerobic benzene degradation. So this tool gives us the ability to not only name an organism, but also to understand the function of that particular organism. So the way that it works is we're going to collect a sample from the environment, like a groundwater sample. We're going to extract all the DNA from that sample and then run individual assays to look at particular genes or organisms that we're interested in and quantify the number and the abundance of those particular organisms of interest. But here's the tricky part about analyzing single targets. Now, I'm not trying to give you an eye exam here on the right-hand side of your screen, but I wanted to show how complex this is. In the case of petroleum hydrocarbons, there are numerous degradation pathways. So on the right side of the slide, what you're seeing there are just some biodegradation pathways for aromatic hydrocarbons from a paper that Fuentes put out. Now, these are only aerobic pathways, and we also know that there's a number of anaerobic pathways. And then if you put on top of that, there's pathways that are suspected or that are completely unknown. So this is very complex to be able to look at all of these different components in our system and to look at all these different pathways. And then think about petroleum sites. Most of the time when we're talking about petroleum hydrocarbons, we're not talking about a single compound. We usually have mixtures of compounds that are present at the site, for instance, benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, xylene, naphthalene, just a whole variety of constituents that can be present at our site. So if we look at toluene alone, for example, what I'm showing here are the first steps in the biodegradation pathways for toluene. Next to each arrow are gene targets that relate to the enzymes that activate these first steps. As you can see, there are five aerobic pathways and one anaerobic pathway that's currently known for toluene degradation, and that's just toluene. So if we take in all the other petroleum hydrocarbons, we can have a lot of different genes that we need to look at to understand these biodegradation pathways. Now, I want you to keep in mind that this applies to more than just environmental biodegradation. This paper from Van de Wiet in 2005 showed that polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, or PAHs, passing through a human system can be converted to estrogenic compounds by the colon microbiota. And so many of these PAHs are known and reported to be toxic. In fact, we get samples from sites around the world that are impacted by these. But this research shows that the risk may still be underestimated due to the biotransformation of these compounds that actually happen while they're in our bodies. Of course, this doesn't just apply to PAHs. We know a number of toxins are modulated by the human microbiome. In some cases, the microbiota can reduce the toxicity of a compound or a metal in situ, and in other cases, it actually increases the toxicity. Now, I should point out that the paper listed on this slide is a great review paper, and I highly recommend it. It's one of the examples that it gives is the methylation of mercury within the gut. Methylmercury, of course, is one of the most toxic forms of mercury. What was interesting in this paper, though, is that it gives examples of pregnant women in Tanzania. Those who took a regular probiotic had actually lower levels of mercury and arsenic because the microbiota decreased the toxin's bioavailability. So this points out that an individual's microbiome determines how toxic a toxin really is. It can determine what happens to that toxin and how quickly it's going to break down. And the same is true for environmental microbiomes. What microbes are dominating the degradation pathways at a site? How do we know what targets to look for? Well, sometimes that can be really complex, as I just mentioned, for petroleum hydrocarbons. There can be a lot of genes that we're interested in. So doing individual qPCR assays can be very cumbersome and expensive. So one of the tools that we use now is called the Quantaray approach. It's where we collect a sample and extract the DNA, but rather than running individual assays, we use an array platform, and we take nanoliter volumes of qPCR reactions so that we can do them in a very small platform, but still get the same accurate quantification. So that little square would be a sample, and within each square are little through holes, so the reactions happen individually. We don't have to worry about interaction interference like we do with other microarray type platforms. So this gives us the ability to do individual qPCR assays in tandem, so we can get 56 different assays and results all at the same time. So very beneficial when we're trying to understand what's happening at our site to be able to look at all of those degradation pathways. But the next question that we have is, even if we know what's there and in what numbers, how do we then translate that to actionable data? Well, Microbial Insights has been processing these samples for the past 30 years, so we've pulled all this information into a database to help us add some context to what it means when you get a certain detection at a site. So if you analyze for a particular gene, then you can look at the distribution within these 50,000 samples to see, is the concentration of the gene on the high end of the scale? Am I in the middle of the scale, or am I on the low end? Do I probably need to do something to stimulate that biodegradation pathway? But we can actually take this even a step further. We know, again, based on these over 50,000 samples, that gene quantification can give us some clear insight into the potential for degradation. But how do I look at this to make sure actual degradation is happening at our sites? How do I know what's happening in situ? So we have a tool that we use for that. But first, I need to introduce a sampling device that we use called the BioTrap. BioTraps were developed by the University of Tulsa and DuPont. They're made of powdered activated carbon and Nomex. Nomex provides the structure for the little bioset beads that are formed. It's kind of like having chicken wire that's housing and holding that powdered activated carbon. Plus, Nomex is what a fire retardant suit's made from. So it gives us the ability to fire these at very high temperatures so there's no fossil biomarkers. Well, the combination of these two makes a very porous surface area, so microorganisms can colonize in these beads, form biofilms. There's about 600 square meters of surface area per gram of beads. So then we can look at our native microorganisms using this tool. And one of the really interesting things that we can do, especially for petroleum hydrocarbons or for other compounds that organisms use as a carbon and energy source, so if they're using it as an electron donor, we can do something called stable isotope probing. I'm going to get into this a little bit more later in just a moment in my presentation, but when we think about carbon that's found in the environment, there are two main types of stable carbon that we can look at. There's carbon-12, which comprises about 99% of the carbon in our environment, and then there's carbon-13, which is the other 1% of what's found in our environment. So in nature, when we see our carbon-12 to carbon-13 naturally shift, we can use that to understand degradation, and I'm going to show you a tool that we use commonly for that a little bit later. But in this case, what I'm going to do is we're going to flip that ratio, and we're going to make a compound, for instance, the benzene that we're interested in, out of 99% carbon-13. So then we can use that as a tracer. So we're going to take our powdered activated carbon, which absorbs compounds really tightly, but they're still bioavailable to microorganisms. We're going to absorb the 13-carbon benzene onto our bioset beads, put them in a PVC housing that we can suspend in a monitoring well. Native bacteria that are already present in the environment are going to start to colonize and form biofilms and attach to the surface of these beads. And then if they can utilize that 13-carbon benzene, for example, they're going to start to degrade that, just like if we had a cheeseburger for lunch today. We'll either start to use it and incorporate it into making more biomass or into waste products. Microorganisms do the same thing, so they're either going to make more microbial biomass cells or they're going to make waste products like carbon dioxide or methane. So what we know is how much carbon-13 benzene we put on the BioTrap in the beginning. We can see how much we lost during that deployment period, which gives us a relative rate of loss. And then more importantly, we can track that heavy-weighted carbon into the lipid membranes of our microbial cells as we make new biomass or into the waste products for dissolved inorganic carbon. And this is a tool that I can see really crossing into the medical field from the bioremediation field, because tracing isotopes is a powerful tool that can give us answers to questions about degradation pathways and end products that we've been asking for years. So So I'm especially excited that NIH is finding ways to bridge these social and scientific gaps between bioremediation and human health. So we talked about how qPCR can give us a way to look at specific microorganisms and quantify gene targets that are related specifically to the contaminants of the site. Then we talked about how stable isotope probing gives us evidence that a contaminant is biodegrading. But what if we want to look at the bigger picture? What if we want to look into the diversity of the environmental microbiome? Or what if we have an emerging contaminant that we don't know the pathway and how that's impacting our microbiome? We can use a tool called next-generation sequencing. Next-generation sequencing is where we take generic primers that amplify all the DNA present within our sample, and we get genera-level identifications of the different microorganisms. So you can do pie charts like you see there in the lower right-hand corner showing different genera of microorganism and their relative abundance within that sample. So in this case, for instance, this sample is heavily dominated by Dichloromonas and Geobacter, and we can look at the number of reads compared to the total reads that we were able to identify and get a percentage abundance of those organisms within that pie chart. We can also look at the descriptions of what we know for this genera of organisms to get some interesting information. And there's a lot of ways that we can analyze next-generation sequencing data, including statistical tools like principal component analysis. But I'm showing one of my favorite ways here, which is hierarchical clustering. This is a great tool for data analysis because it provides an easy way to comprehend data visualization, but also a statistical component. So what we're doing here is hierarchical analysis takes that genera, and each of those in the bar chart that you see, a genera is a particular color, and then it's going to closely group onto each of these nodes the different genera of organisms that we're detecting. So you can see the blue bars here and the samples that are most closely related that have a lot of this blue particular bar grouped together. And as we move into these different nodes, you can see these two samples are closer in relation than the other samples within this group, but these all kind of group together. And so if we look at this, and I'm not going to go into detail about the site with these samples were received from, but I want to point out the samples within the blue box, all of which cluster together off of that first node, are from background wells, parts of the site that were not impacted by contaminants. And the orange box, however, are samples from wells that were impacted by contamination. And you can definitely see a clear change in the diversity of the microorganisms. And that's really important to note because changes in diversity of a microbiome are really important. When it comes to the gut microbiome, we know this without a doubt. Studies have shown how microbial diversity within mice changed dramatically when exposed to heavy metals and toxic elements. Certain chemical components and herbicides have also correlated with changes in the gut microbiota of mice and have resulted in depression and anxiety symptoms. So monitoring microbial diversity within a microbiome, either environmental or gut, can help paint a clearer picture and identify the specific impacts that are related to our toxic contamination. All right, as I sum up today, we've talked about petroleum hydrocarbons when it comes to environmental remediation. So I want to turn toward another common environmental contaminant and talk briefly about chlorinated solvents. Now, Amin, who's up next, is going to go into this and discuss chlorinated solvents in much more detail, so I'm not going to spend a long time, but I do want to highlight a few things. These solvents, like tetrachloroethene and trichloroethene, are commonly used in dry cleaners and manufacturing facilities. They were used as degreasers for many years. So when released into the environment, there are a number of anaerobic microorganisms that can use these as electron acceptors. So if the right microbes are present, the PCE is reduced to TCE, which is reduced to cis-DCE, which is in turn reduced to vinyl chloride, and finally to ethene. Now, the problem with this degradation process is that each resulting daughter product is more and more carcinogenic until you get to ethene, which is completely non-toxic. So we've got to make sure we get all the way there. Furthermore, there are very few microbes that are able to utilize these compounds past cis-DCE. Dehalococcoides is one of the only known microorganisms that can be able to degrade PCE all the way to ethene on its own. So if we don't have Dehalococcoides at our site, we know that we're probably not going to degrade our PCE, and we're going to get a degradation stall at a more toxic compound than it actually started with. So this relates back to what I mentioned previously. Certain microbes can modulate a toxin to be even more toxic than when it started. The right conditions and microbial diversity are really needed for complete detoxification. So we can use tools like quantitative PCR to look and see if we have the right microbes present. Do we have the Haemococcus present? Are they in sufficient abundance based on the database that will likely to get efficient reductive dechlorination? But how do we know if a contaminant in the environment is actually degrading? We can look at a few things like concentration. We can see how the concentration of our contaminant is changing, the concentration of the microorganisms. But how do we know if that concentration is decreasing because of degradation or because of something else like absorption or dilution? That's when we turn to an analysis called compound-specific isotope analysis in order to directly prove that a contaminant is degrading. So let's talk about degradation really quickly. Anytime a contaminant is degrading, it means the bonds are being broken. So let's look at TCE as an example. As TCE degrades, the carbon and chlorine bond is broken, and the chlorine is replaced with a hydrogen. This results in the production of the daughter product cis-TCE, as you see here. Now, in nature, as I mentioned before, there are two main kinds of stable carbon that we can measure. Carbon-12 is most common, making up 99% of the carbon. 13 is just one neutron heavier, making up the other 1%. These two types of carbon act almost exactly the same except one thing. Carbon-13 makes slightly stronger bonds, which means as TCE degrades, carbon-12 bonds tend to break first, leaving carbon-13 behind. So if we measure the ratio of carbon-13 to carbon-12, we can see it increase as TCE degrades because more and more carbon-13 will be left behind. That's exactly what we do with CSIA analysis. The best part is that the carbon ratios are unaffected by physical processes like adsorption, desorption, volatilization, or dilution. So it's a way to directly prove that a contaminant is degrading at a site. We can also gain even more information from this analysis and use it to narrow down what type of mechanism is taking place. Are we experiencing biodegradation or is it abiotic degradation? And we can apply it to source delineation investigations. Before I finish up today, I want to briefly discuss where I think the future of MBTs might go. The first thing we need to do when discussing the future of bioremediation is determine where the data gaps are. qPCR and tools like QuantArray provide insight into potential for bioremediation at a site, so we can get a lot of information and quantify a lot of the genes that are known to be present at our site. But what about activity? There's tools that we didn't talk about today, like looking at RNA analysis rather than DNA. We're also doing a lot of work with proteomics to see how the enzymes are actively being generated. And while there are certain challenges with each different molecule that we target, these analyses have been studied in depth, and we're going to see these more commercially available over time. What about the overall microbiome? We talked about the big picture, and we know that next-generation sequencing can provide insights into diversity of the microbiome. But how do we understand the overall health of the key players that are there? How do we interpret that into something meaningful? We also know that we can prove a contaminant's being degraded. We can use tools that we talked about today, like stable isotope probing and CSIA. But how do we more effectively predict future degradation trends? What if we could do more? What if we can predict a stall or determine how active or inactive the key degraders are within our subsurface microbiome? In 1997, metabolites were analyzed in the blood of 44,168 individuals. Metabolites is a fancy word for small molecules, so all detected small molecules within the blood of over 40,000 people were analyzed. And over the following 17 years, 5,512 of those individuals died. And Joris Deline, who did this research, found that the metabolites detected in 1997 had a strong correlation with overall mortality. Not only that, but as described in his 2019 publication I've shown here, the metabolic profiles of the individuals acted as a better indicator of mortality than most conventional risk factors such as body mass, blood pressure, cholesterol, actually even using all of those risk factors combined. So metabolomics, the study of the small molecules within a sample, has been shown to be a powerful tool when combined with the right statistical analysis. So we started to imagine what it would look like if we could apply this analysis to the environmental field. What can we predict? What can we learn? And that's exactly what we're working on. Through our current NIH SBIR grant, Microbial Insights, in conjunction with the University of Tennessee, is using metabolomics for an environmental focus. As you can imagine, science has come a long way since 1997 that we showed on the previous slide. Now we can actually detect thousands of small molecules within a single sample. Now it's important before I move forward to clarify that we don't know what each and every one of these molecules is. In fact, we usually only know about 80 to 100 compounds per sample. So instead, what we're doing is looking at our overall profile, seeing what that looks like, the collection of peaks in the chromatography data. So by comparing these profiles between samples in controlled or known conditions, we can begin to identify patterns that can help us predict what will happen in the subsurface. Here on the right is a principal coordinate analysis and some preliminary data from this research showing that even the metabolic profiles of pure cultures are distinctive from one another. You can see three different strains of Dehalococcoides there and Dechloromonas, and they clearly group into different areas, and the Dechloromonas is separate from Dehalococcoides. So that was our first step. The next thing that we did was to move to some bench scale microcosms containing chlorinated solvent degraders along with different chlorinated solvents of interest. The microcosms were sampled at different time points, beginning prior to the introduction of the contaminant and ending well after the contaminant was completely degraded to ethene. The samples were analyzed using ultra-high performance liquid chromatography combined with high-resolution mass spectrometry, and the profiles were compared against the percentage of the contaminant remaining. As you can see in the PCA plots here, clear differences are observable within the metabolic profiles between time points in this preliminary study. So we're really excited about the data that continues to come out of this study and the opportunity for this research that was provided by NIH through the SBIR grant. Currently, we've been working on ways to sample these metabolomes in the environment to make sure we're preserving them effectively to get them back to the laboratory for analysis. And then we'll move to looking at profiles from different chlorinated sites where we're experiencing cis-CCE stalls and we're not, to see how predictive we can be with this particular tool. So keep a lookout in the future as we're moving through this research. We'll hopefully have some very interesting tools that we can use. So at the end of the day, it's really important for all of us to remember the impact on our personal microbiota and how it's connected to human health. So this, I ask our marketing group to put together this image, this visual, because groundwater is really the central for everything, as Pedro was just talking about earlier. Really impacts our agriculture and our animal health, which then, of course, comes into the foods we eat. Soil is important, urbanization and wastewater. Microbial Insights does a lot of work looking at the microbes that are present in wastewater processes. Also looking at microbial-influenced corrosion and how that's affecting our pipelines and our industry, causing more releases into the environment. And then looking at surface waters, what impacts do we have in our surface waters and our recreational waters? Are we seeing fecal contamination? What's the host organism of that fecal contamination so that we can better delineate and preserve our groundwater systems and therefore impact our human health? So as I close out today, there have been two questions posed to us through these sessions, and if you've missed any of these sessions, I'd really recommend that you go back and look at them. One of the questions posed to us was, when should we not use bioremediation? And I think bioremediation is a great tool. I've seen it work in very high concentration contaminant sites, but typically it's used as a polishing tool after other technologies have been utilized at a site. The very green process that we can use. And if you go back and listen to session two and some of the work that Claudia is doing, you can see how we can enhance those microbial processes with bioaugmentation of different organisms or horizontal gene transfer. So there's a lot of potential in the future as we learn more about this. And you know, the tools that we have for genomics and proteomics and metabolomics all combined together can give us a multiple line of evidence approach to help us really understand what's happening in these complex systems so we can do a better job of remediating. So thank you very much for all your time today. Again, I'm excited about NIH's initiative to bridge some of the gaps between human health and environmental health, and I'm honored to be part of the presentation today, and I'll be happy to take any questions that you guys have.
Thank you, Dora. So for our participants online, I want to remind you to use that Q&A pod down the lower right to enter your questions. I've got a few that have come in. Dora, we've got time for a handful. So first off, I have a participant ask about what type of
test methods or equipment are available for measuring C12 and C13 on your sites. So I think that the CSIA is kind of what they're referring to. Can you give a little more idea of what that involves for, like, is any of this done in the field, what's done in the lab, and just kind of paint a picture of how that works?
Sure, I'll be glad to do that. So unfortunately right now, because of the complexity of the instrumentation that's needed, most of these tools are done in the lab. We just get cleaner DNA extractions to be able to look at qPCR processes. We've been involved in a lot of field validation, but to date I haven't found anything that I think is better than a screening tool for that. And when it comes to CSIA, you have to have pretty complex instrumentation to be able to separate the 12C from the 13C. You think there's only one neutron difference in the weight of that compound. So it's pretty sensitive instrumentation. We have to use mass specs that are very high level to be able to do that. So all of that is performed in the lab at this point. And I think it'll be a good bit before we see any of that on a field scale.
Great. Thank you. Now, can you talk about, is it possible to determine using CSIA how long ago degradation occurred, or kind of see what the time scale is?
You know, there's some carbon dating applications that have been done, but because of the complexity of biodegradation at sites, it's really difficult to predict an age dating with CSIA alone. I would say it would be site dependent, and you probably have to have a lot of characterization to be able to do that.
Okay. So, yeah, having before and after would definitely help, right?
Definitely.
if you can. Now, let's see. I've got time for just a couple more. Can you talk a little about the progress by Microbial Insights or any other researchers that you're aware of on identifying other defluorinating microorganisms?
Yes, I'm assuming someone's probably interested in the PFAS kind of contamination, and I know there's a lot of work that are being done by researchers on there on defluorination pathways. There's some interesting work that's come out of a number of different labs looking at fungi that can do it, as well as potentially some microbes that are involved in the process. The problem I've seen so far when it comes to PFAS, and PFAS in particular, is it seems that a lot of it, the organisms modulate, it becomes a more toxic compound or more mobile compound. So I haven't seen anything that isn't going to cause that problem so far. But I think there's some pretty cutting edge research that's on the horizon. I'm just waiting till they move it to the field to test it and see how that goes.
Sounds good. Thank you. Now, let me just remind folks, if you're on the phone, if you have any questions, I can let you take your phone off of mute by pressing pound 6, and you can unmute yourself and ask a question to Dora right now. If I don't hear any, or if I don't see another one come in online right now, oh, I see one. Let's see. Okay. Remind folks that if you do have any more questions, make sure you type them into that Q&A pod. Let's see. Sorry, I have one more here. Can CSIA be used as a forensic tool to find out the source of contamination?
Yeah, it's possible to delineate sources with CSIA. That's probably one of the best uses of the tool. Again, you have to really characterize that site and do quite a bit of sampling to make sure that you get a clear delineation of where that source originated. But it is possible, and it's commonly done.
Okay, great. Thank you, Dora. Okay, right, now we are going to, thanks again for your presentation. We will move on to our next speaker. Next, we will hear from Amin Razavi, who leads the Early Technology Development and Innovation Team at Microbi Biotechnologies, focusing on the conceptual development of new technologies and the company's technology pipeline. He is responsible for Microbi's research and development funding, including multi-million dollar grants, as well as a co-inventor of Microbi's core patent portfolio. As a key inventor behind the microniche engineering technology, Amin has developed a number of tools in material science, microbial ecology, and bioprocess development to provide enhanced bioconversion processes.
He is also a coordinator of Microbes joint research projects with various universities such as Johns Hopkins University and the University of California at Berkeley. Amin holds a degree in microbial biology from the University of California, Berkeley, and advanced training in engineering management from Stanford University. Amin, I will now turn it over to you.
Hello, everyone. Thank you, Cindy, for the introduction. It's a great pleasure and honor to present today after the very informative presentations by Pedro and Dora. Thank you also to the NIH for hosting these webinars. So Pedro spoke about the use of nanotechnology, which is a wonderful example of multidisciplinary collaboration to help improve remediation, how we can work across different disciplines. And in a similar vein, I'll be talking about the use of material science, and later on the use of computational modeling as another way to integrate different disciplines into traditional bioremediation sciences. And Dora's great presentation spoke in great detail about the microbiomes and the use of sequencing and analytical technologies. Her work and the work of others like her is truly driving a lot of, the newer science around bioremediation, and it also forms the critical foundation for computational modeling. Later in my presentation, I'll describe one of the modeling platforms that Microbia has been involved with and how it builds on sequencing data to help advance the field of bioremediation. My presentation has three parts. First, I'll provide an introduction to co-metabolism by discussing some of the major organic compounds that co-metabolism can help address and mitigate. I'll talk about some of the advantages and then also some of the key technical challenges. In part two, I'll discuss microenvironmental engineering. This is a core discipline that Microbia is focused on, and I'll talk about our approach to microenvironmental engineering called microniche engineering. I'll discuss a Superfund research program funded project by Microbia that looks to combine microenvironmental engineering with co-metabolism to help treat different kinds of recalcitrant or hard-to-degrade organic compounds to below regulatory levels. And finally, in part three, I'll switch to another SRP-funded project involving the use of computational modeling to build functional predictive models, as Dora emphasized, that can help enhance our understanding of natural and engineered microbiomes, but it can also inform decision-making about technology development and intervention strategies. Before I get into the technical details, I'd like to briefly introduce Microbia. We are a social impact company based in the San Francisco Bay Area, founded about 10 years ago to help work at the interface between material science and biology. We offer several of our technologies commercially. For example, we have a flagship technology for nitrate treatment, which also originated in part in an SRP-funded project. That technology called Denitrovi has been commercial for the past 5 or 6 years in the United States and the Asia Pacific region. And our latest full-scale installation in Southern California, which we're very excited about, and it'll be finished by the end of this year, it'll treat up to 1 billion gallons of nitrate contaminated water per year. And this speaks to the focus of Microbia as a company focused on 21st century challenges, certainly the lack of clean drinking water, but also climate change, environmental degradation, dependence on petroleum, and other similar challenges. So part one, co-metabolism. At its most basic level, co-metabolism is a very broad category of microbial degradation strategies and pathways that have been indicated for a variety of organic compounds. Some of the major compounds are shown here. We see representation by chlorinated solvents such as trichloroethylene, TCE, perchloroethylene and others. We also see compounds such as NDMA, PCBs, BTEX, 1,4-dioxane. In fact, one study estimated more than 100 compounds of priority and interest to Superfund and drinking water applications can be degraded through co-metabolism. And it's found that co-metabolism is especially useful in the case of compounds that resist direct oxidation, aren't effectively degraded anaerobically, or when regulations stipulate treatment goals that are below the levels known to provide carbon or energy benefits to the microorganisms. So, as I move to the next slide, I just wanted to provide one map of volatile organic compounds in drinking water. I can't provide, obviously, capture the extensive range of all of these compounds in one map. It might color the entire United States, but at least one of these compounds have been studied, and this category of compounds is readily addressed through co-metabolism. It's widespread, and a number of studies have indicated volatile organic compounds as increasing the risk of certain kinds of cancer. So a little bit more detail about co-metabolism, and I'll talk specifically about aerobic co-metabolism. So one well-studied case is shown here. Co-metabolism basically works when a primary substrate, such as methane, induces the production of a general enzyme. In this case, it's SMMO, which stands for soluble methane monooxygenase. That's coupled to a terminal electron acceptor oxygen. This serendipitous expression of SMMO also binds to a secondary substrate, TCE, which is degraded into unstable epoxides that decompose into innocuous byproducts. Co-metabolism can enable the degradation of certain compounds, especially non-naturally occurring compounds called xenobiotics, but it can also lead to faster degradation of compounds that are degraded aerobically. In the case of TCE, one study found a 50-fold increase in the rate of degradation using SMMO by a methanotroph, Methylocyanus trichosporium, compared to the direct oxidation of TCE by a Pseudomonas species. Co-metabolism can also consolidate the biodegradation of multiple kinds of organic compounds. This is relevant because our contaminated sites are generally not contaminated with just one organic compound, but combinations and mixtures in various levels that can also shift over time. And aerobic co-metabolism has the advantage of preventing the buildup of dehalogenation byproducts, such as vinyl chloride, which Dor mentioned. Some of these byproducts can be even more toxic. They can inhibit oxygenase enzymes. They can also inhibit bioactivity. And finally, aerobic co-metabolism, it generally doesn't deplete the terminal electron acceptors in that environment, such that redox conditions are not radically altered, which may otherwise be a problem in the case of inadvertently solubilizing heavy metals when redox conditions change. Of course, co-metabolism also has certain technical challenges. It is dependent on the ability of microorganisms in that reactor zone or in that treatment zone to have the capability to do this co-metabolism. And since many of our bioremediation approaches rely on indigenous organisms, that can be unknown or difficult to control. A second major challenge is that efficient bioremediation depends on maintaining high enzyme activity for extended periods of time. And well-studied co-metabolic systems, such as those based on methane induction, like I mentioned in the previous slide, are challenged by the low solubility of methane. This is rate limiting and can also lead to unpredictable induction kinetics. And finally, going back to the composition point, if a slow-growing organism is necessary for co-metabolism, as many methanotrophs are, the bioremediation system could have startup periods of weeks, months, or longer. It can lack robustness, and it can also be easily competitively inhibited by changing or migrating water conditions. So what is a potential solution to this? We're now in part two, focusing on microenvironmental engineering. At Microbi, we define microenvironmental engineering as understanding and influencing the most immediate environment of the microbial community. And this is a very dynamic system. It includes a range of the stimuli that's experienced by a microbial cell, which influences the expression of its genes, the development and concentration of enzymes that we can see through transcriptomic, proteomic, or metabolomic analysis, all of those forms of analyses can provide information about how microorganisms are responding to environmental stimuli. And obviously, the microenvironmental interface is highly influenced by the larger system. At the most basic level, when we provide nutrients or substrates, when we stimulate the environment, or we're designing a reactor that's being aerated, we're influencing that interface. But really narrowing down and engineering that interface is challenging beyond the kind of a macro level. And so this is part of where our approach comes in. We call our technical platform micro-niche engineering because we are essentially using a material science approach that defines parameters specific to the strain and process, and then we develop components that can be integrated within a reactor or even in some case fully enclose a microbial culture that can provide certain benefits. And so this is a combinatorial process. It proceeds kind of based on defining these parameters and then empirically down selecting based off of the properties of materials that appear to meet certain of the benchmarks that we're looking for. Once we have those benchmarks, then we optimize the structure, function, and performance of the composites. And if you're interested, we published a 2018 chapter in a book called Biocatalysis by the Royal Society of Chemistry that provides additional detail on our microniche engineering process. And so what does a microniche engineering composite look like and how is it applied? The short answer is that the composite development is kind of agnostic to the mode of application because the process determines the size of the composite, it determines its geometric shape, the internal architecture, the chemical, physical properties that it has. In the case of the project we are working on for the aerobic co-metabolism of chlorinated hydrocarbons, we develop spherical composites that have a complex heterogeneous internal structure, and those composites can be applied in situ as a kind of treatment zone technology or as an ex situ pump and treat technology. And on this next slide, you can see a scanning electron micrograph or an SEM of a down-selected composite where, in this case, the design optimized for hydrophobic vectors or veins throughout the heterogeneous structure that helps deliver sparingly soluble substrates like methane to an interface that's populated by a high density of microorganisms. And we found that this particular design not only helped in the delivery and transfer of the substrates, but it also helped create a gradient that increased the microenvironmental bioavailability of these substrates. On the right side of this slide, we have studies comparing the concentrations, internal concentrations of propane and methane achieved by CC6, which is one of the later composite developments compared to water. And you see an improvement that's remarkable considering that this is at ambient temperature and ambient pressure. Following the development of a new biocatalyst for an application, we proceeded to do batch studies to understand the kinetics and then develop continuous flow prototypes. In this case, I'm showing the data for TCE degradation, but data from a confidential client, we also showed a variety of chlorinated compounds and one for dioxane, where all of these were degraded kind of simultaneously in time frames that exceed the control system, which lacked the composite material design. It lacked the microenvironmental properties that were developed as part of the biocatalyst composites. And so this work is subject to an ongoing phase two project at a customer site and also the development of derivative applications where the enhancement of the microenvironmental bioavailability of a substrate provides a performance benefit. So I'd now like to move on to part three, which is another project funded by the Superfund Research Program. It was led by Microbi. We collaborated with the University of California, Berkeley, and another company became involved called Next Silico, also based in Berkeley. And this project focused on extending microbiome research to develop a functional model that can be used for predictive capabilities. And this model is called EnviroABM. And I'll explain why we call it EnviroABM. And so, but to preface that, while microbiome research has largely focused on human environments, there is increasing attention to microbiomes in soil, agriculture, the built environment, and environmental microbiomes that can be relevant to bioremediation. We have had a lot of success from the Human Microbiome Project, and now we have the Earth Microbiome Project. And much of the findings between different kinds of microbiomes are translational. So what we learn from one microbiome helps our understanding of other microbiomes, which Dora emphasized so appropriately. But I think it's also worth considering that the state of microbiome research is still early with a lot of potential to grow. The majority of published work in the microbiome sciences focuses on the compositions of microorganisms across time and space. So when we study a microbiome system, typically our first step has been to look at a standard or typical composition, determine how compositions change when they're disrupted, and then develop associations between different microbiome compositions and various organism or system dysfunctions. And the growth of bioinformatics databases with this information has been amazing, astonishing. It's grown exponentially, even while the underlying mechanisms of microbiome behavior still have significant gaps in understanding. And I think this underscores how metagenomics and the sequencing technologies are the critical first step, but the field will realize its technological potential through predictive computational models. And so in this SRP-funded project, we collaborated to help develop a modeling platform called EnviroABM. The ABM stands for agent-based modeling. Sometimes agent-based modeling is also called individual-based modeling. And basically, agent-based modeling defines governing rules for defined agents. These agents can be as small as a single microbial cell. They can be types of microorganisms, and they can also be different kinds of systems within that three-dimensional space that's being modeled. And ABM allows these agents to behave according to these rules for a period of time. And so we can compare the outputs of this model with actual experimental data to probe at the behavioral mechanisms and to provide, I think, a very powerful platform for precision technology development. What ABM can do is it can fill in some of the gaps that some other kinds of statistical analysis technologies can't illustrate because they are unable to capture the individual heterogeneity within that microbiome or the microbiome-based treatment reactor. Another advantage of ABM is that it provides a customizable platform for various bioremediation situations. In this project, we validate the model through understanding the degradation of BTEX, benzene, toluene, ethylbenzenes, and xylenes, but we're also looking at other kinds of contaminants and other kinds of matrices. So beyond looking at an aqueous matrix, we can look at matrices that have physical properties inherent, like a soil matrix. A third benefit of EnviroABM is that it can integrate with other modeling tools, such as hydrogeochemical models. It's very effective at small-scale modeling, but we also have computational tools to help bridge the gap so that two models can kind of work together and inform each other. And finally, EnviroABM works hand-in-hand with next-generation sequencing and advanced analytical technologies, especially when these tools allow us to better understand sites at lower costs and with greater ease, because this provides the foundational data that helps design the governing rules for the computational model. And the better rules that we have, the more effectively we can predict how that inherent heterogeneity is going to be impacting the overall performance of the system. And so finally, I wanted to propose some future directions for work in this area. First, we feel it's very critical to fund improved microbiome tools and techniques. This is the basis of our ability to understand these complex behaviors and interactions. And we also feel that we have to help catalyze that shift from just understanding the composition of microbiomes to a more functional understanding. We have to be able to develop tools like computational techniques to be able to translate the vast bioinformatics data sets into useful technologies. And this leads me to my final point, which is the integration of new sciences and platforms within the existing kind of theoretical, economic, and physical infrastructure for remediation and treatment in general. These kinds of applications, bioremediation certainly, but also we have drinking water treatment, air pollution mitigation, carbon capture, they're really a social and environmental service. And as long as we need to be able to advance these technologies, we need to get elected officials, regulatory agencies, engineering consulting companies, site owners, and even advocates kind of all on the same page. This is a critical kind of social element for us to be able to help deliver on the promise of these new technologies to help address our 21st century challenges. Thank you again for your time. I look forward to your questions.
Thank you for your presentation, Amin. I will take some questions now from the audience. So if you have any questions for Amin, please type them into that Q&A pod down in the lower right of your screen. Let's see, as those come in, I'll go ahead and start with a couple here. Amin, what are some of the limitations you've seen with computational modeling when it comes to bioremediation applications?
Sure, that's a great question, because as long as we appreciate that our understanding of the microbiome is in its early stages, computational modeling based off of the microbiome is arguably at a far earlier stage. And so I think the main limitation is limited by the availability and validation of the data underlying the model development and the robustness of the validation procedures. It's a common misconception that computational models are kind of fit to the data. But it is true that the data informs the way that computational rules are designed. The better data that we have, the faster we can develop useful computational models and the more applications we can have. And I think another challenge in computational modeling is the ability of different research groups to interact to develop core computational models, because one group can only do so much. But with collaborations, we can exchange data, we can exchange results, we can perform wider scale validation, and hopefully develop tools that can become more or less standardized as part of the computational toolkit as academic groups and also companies look to advance the field of bioremediation.
Those are excellent points. Thank you. Now, can you talk about what are some of the challenges you see with commercializing new technologies in the bioremediation sector?
Sure. So I think a primary challenge is that we are working in a market where you really cannot make mistakes. This creates a high technical and regulatory barrier that can only be overcome through persistent effort and some of the broad-based partnerships that I mentioned. And so one example was Microbi's development of the nitrate treatment system. We implemented this system in the United States in Pasadena, and it's been operating for more than 2 years, but it also took at least 2 years to develop, demonstrate, and obtain regulatory approval. And so now the technology is fully approved in California and other states. Now we have the opportunity to implement new kinds of projects. For example, we have one ongoing partnership with certain disadvantaged communities in California to develop community-scale water treatment systems that can be integrated into regional solutions. And so when we talk about a technology kind of acceptance life cycle, there really is a gap after developing a technology and gaining interest and confidence from the first acceptors of that technology. And I'm glad that programs such as SBIR are continuing to focus more on how the translational benefits of the research that's done is greatly enhanced through commercialization assistance programs and things like that.
Thank you. So when you're talking about data acquisition, what level of data are you acquiring? Like, do you need more than just what is available at a typical site? Or do you need to go out and seek more chemical and biological data, and what kind of costs might be associated with that?
Sure. So our objective is to work based off of the typical site data. So at a typical site, you'll have samples, you'll know concentrations of the contaminants of interest, you will have hopefully some understanding of how those concentrations are changing or migrating. A typical site may also have some hydrological modeling, if it's a groundwater system. And so that's the kind of data that we're hoping to be able to work with on that basis alone. But the real kind of missing piece that helps bring at least this computational modeling approach to life is an understanding of the microorganisms in that system. And so a typical Superfund site, unless they're working with a university or an academic group, they won't have done even basic analysis of different time points. And it's also worth considering that the scale that we're working at a microbial level can vary widely when we're talking about sites that are acres and very large. And so what we do is we will narrow down and focus on a particular component of that site. So in a pump and treat system, it's usually we're trying to understand the microbial composition that's being pumped and treated, and that helps lower the cost. But then we're also looking as kind of a bridge with this data gap to use a technology like EnviroABM as a technology design platform, so that as we're developing microbial-based technologies for remediating an application, as I mentioned, in situ or ex situ, at least we'll have that information for the reactor or the treatment zone. That can also help reduce the cost. And the last point I'll mention is that I think as sequencing technologies continue to advance, we continue to see a reduction in cost. And so what could have been hugely cost prohibitive, 5 or 10 years ago, nowadays is actually becoming quite cheap and routine.
Okay, thank you. I want to remind folks you can go ahead and type in your questions in the Q&A pod there. I will open it up to all of the presenters in just a moment here after I finish up questions for Amin. So if you have questions for the other speakers, please also type those in. Let me go to the phone line now. If anyone who's listening in on the phone line has a question for Amin, please press pound six to unmute yourself, and you can speak to Amin. If I don't get any people coming in on the phone, Amin, let me ask you one more question here, and then I'll go to the others. Can you tell me how does your business work with academia? How do you form those partnerships?
Sure. So this is very important for us as a small business, where we don't bring in all of our capabilities in-house. We rely very often in partnerships and collaborations. And so our primary mode of partnership is working with universities on certain research projects. Sometimes the university is leading a project and they're looking to evaluate the applicability of our approach to some of their goals, or sometimes the university has complementary capabilities or interests. These could be sequencing capabilities, analytical capabilities, and we also work with universities that have that are really understanding or developing microbial systems, and they're looking for a way to be able to economically apply that unique metabolic capability that they're studying to solve an environmental challenge. And so we have a number of these collaborations, and we're always looking for more.
Great. Good to know. So for anyone who has those kinds of questions for Amin, I want to remind you that his contact information is on the screen, and also you'll be able to find it on the seminar homepage if you come back there. Okay, I have a question here.
I typed it in for you.
Okay, excuse me. All right, now if anyone has any questions on the phone line, I'll let you go ahead and ask those now.
Do you have any experience evaluating suggestions that co-metabolic processes may be adequate and satisfactory in a monitored natural attenuation context?
Sure. It's not our direct area of expertise, but I understand that co-metabolism has been evaluated as a factor, especially when we're looking at certain biostimulation type interventions. Where I think one of the previous webinars also talked extensively about that topic. There are again those challenges of understanding the microbial consortia, and then if you are biostimulating with something like methane, the solubility of methane, the delivery of methane. I've often heard of cases where the methane is being sourced or maybe another kind of compound that's thought to induce a general enzymatic co-metabolism. But it's not traveling as extensively as it needs to in order to be able to have a broad impact. And so we think that more engineered treatment systems are probably going to be more effective, but of course they're more costly than something like natural attenuation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I thought I heard one other click on the phone. So if someone has a question on the phone line, we'll take that now. Okay, maybe not. Okay, now thank you, Amin, for answering those questions for us. I
don't see more questions coming in for the other speakers. So at this point, I just want to make sure that everyone is aware of the related URLs pod, which contains the seminar resources and seminar feedback links over on the right-hand side. On the seminar resources page, we have assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. We'll place these seminars in an archive with a soundtrack, so in the near future, you'll be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today. Also, in these related URLs, you will find an online seminar feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out this online feedback form. We do look at your comments as we continue to try and improve the content and delivery mechanisms, and we will pass those along. You can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. I'd also like to remind our participants of the various ways to stay connected to ensure you don't miss any webinars. For more information on ETA's CLUIN webinars, please refer to the CLUIN.org website. You can also subscribe to the free monthly e-newsletter, TechDirect, and follow CLUIN on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. We encourage you to visit the SRP RISC e-learning webpage for information about upcoming sessions, and you can also follow SRP on Twitter. If you were not able to attend the first two sessions of the series live, we encourage you to check out the archives and listen in. The archive is now available for the September 30th webinar on the microbiome and for the October 4th webinar on novel omics approaches. With that, it is time to conclude today's webinar. If you submitted an online question, we did not have time to get to it. We will pass those questions along to the presenters who can follow up. If you have additional questions, you can also contact the presenters via email. Their email addresses are on the seminar homepage on CLUIN. I would like to thank our presenters, Pedro Alvarez, Dora Taggart, and Amin Razavi, for their time preparing and for sharing their presentations with us today. This concludes today's presentation. Thank you for your participation.